Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
Are you guys sure you don't want to talk about This Is Us? Are you guys sure that you don't want to talk about This Is Us? Have you really thought about how much meat is
I'm
on the This Is Us?
I'm not emotionally ready to talk about This Is Us. My heart isn't in it.
I love This Is Us.
I mean, what's not to love?
I bet. Characters, welcome. That's characters, what I say. Welcome to die.
Yeah.
Characters, I love watching people get picked off one by one. Milo Ventimiglia, who of course has created three iconic television roles.
Gilmore Girls
at this point.
Second boyfriend.
Gilmore Girls second boy.
Heroes fourth boyfriend.
Heroes Invincible story hole.
Wait,
and
is he in Whitney?
Was he in Whitney? Is what a lot of people were asking right now about.
Chris D'Elia.
Last night, guy. After the big game, we all tuned in to watch this father of three die. And the thing that he tweeted after that was, just so everyone knows it, hashtag Jack Pearson, I guess that's his character from the show, lives in all our hearts. He's you, he's me, he's us. Thank you for supporting the show. Jack Pearson, a character from a program I do not enjoy, lives in my heart. I didn't realize with Jesus already in there that there would be room for Jack Pearson from This Is Us as well.
Hanging
but
out.
He is apparently in there.
You'd think you could find Jesus a better roommate in your heart. Also, what's the square footage of your heart? Because it's got to be getting cramped in there.
It could be like a duplex. I think it's fine.
There's two things that live in my heart are Milo Ventimiglia and Jesus. My name is Justin McElroy, and I know the best game of the month.
My name is Griffin McElroy, and I know the best game of the month.
My name is Chris Plant, and I know the best game of the month.
My name is Russ Frushick, and I know the best game of 2018.
Welcome to the Besties, where we celebrate the latest and greatest in pop culture,
this
history,
is us.
News. This is us. This is us. The guys who talk about fashion. And sports, the big game, going to do a recap of that at some point. But this week, we're going to focus in on, really drill down on video games. I was watching my nephew, Pearson, play one of these yesterday. And let me tell you, folks, they have come a long way since Pac-Man.
Yeah, definitely need to mention here that I did change my son's name to Pearson, so Justin was not lying there. Took a while.
His full name is Jack Pearson McElroy.
Video games, man. Video games. I don't think it's the January 2017 was so buck wild. I don't know if 2018 quite lived up to it, but man, this is a good old month, huh? This is a good little month.
It was. There was a lot of games that came out this month.
Does anybody have any honorable mentions that went?
I have a huge one. It kind of breaks my heart that we didn't have like room for it in the proper discussion, but it's a game I wanted to talk about because I was so like entranced by it. Was Iconoclasts. It's out on, I think, Steam and like console download stores. It's by, oh gosh, Joaquim. I can't remember his full name, but he basically worked on it, solo for a long time. The game's been in the works for like a decade and now it's finally out. And this is the developer behind the, Noi to Love, games. I think it's a series. I'm not like very familiar with his body of work before Iconoclasts, but it is a really, really cool game. It's like a story driven, like surprisingly heavily story driven, like platformer action adventure game, where it takes place in this sort of dying world with this sort of religious monarchy, where there is like a mother who's sort of a deity who talks to this space god who governs the things that happen on the planet. And it has a lot of things to say about like how these different different sort of societies have conflict, despite the fact that they kind of believe in sort of the same stuff. And it drills down really deep into how this religion like governs this world. And on top of that, like it's like a really good little Metroidvania game with like really cool like mechanics and a really satisfying feeling like upgrade path. You find like different weapons, different guns, and like an upgradable wrench that you can use for not only combat, but like some platforming puzzle solving stuff too. I played through all of it in like 3 days, and I was in love.
Yeah, I played a couple hours of it and really liked it. It reminded me of Cave Story, and
yes,
insofar
absolutely.
As it was like story centric Metroidvania, and with like interesting boss fights and stuff like that, but also like actual cutscenes and fun like musical cues for enemies, and they obviously put a lot of love into it.
The Cave Story comparison really hit for me also because it like Cave Story is a game that kind of on the surface just looks like kind of a cute pixel platformer, but actually has like a really like ocean deep lore for you to dig into, and it's like really really great. Like the world is so rich and well developed.
Yeah. Another game that I wanted to mention for honorable mention is a game called Darkest Dungeon, which came out like
100 years ago
on PC. And I never played it, but it came to Switch and I put it on Switch this month. And it's very, very overwhelming, but cool and interesting and like really high production value. It's basically an RPG strategy game where you are you're basically running an RPG town for all intents and purposes, and sending people out to like on missions, and then you get a percentage of their spoils, as it were. And it's kind of an interesting shift, because like when I normally play these sorts of games, I play them like perfectly. Oh, I lost a guy. I can't, you know, I'll just reload a save. But in this, you can't, because it autosaves almost constantly. And B, it's actually counter to like making money. Like you're supposed to be willing to sacrifice people. And people go insane by like witnessing too many horrors. It's got like a Cthulhu thing. And so you can like basically sacrifice people and be like, well, he wasn't doing great anyway. I'm going to send him in and I'll still get some money out of it. And it's obviously for Switch, it's great because it's, you know, 2D. You can stop at any point, turn-based. Just really a good fit for the platform.
So. I've tried 3 times to play that game because everything about it is so absolutely my jam.
Yeah.
But I find myself so turned off by how, like, if you have a bad run and lose several of your heroes in, like, one dive, it always feels so punishing to me. Like, in a way that is not, like, it makes me kind of not want to keep going, because then it makes me think, like, well, if it doesn't really... It's sort of and I'm not saying that like roguelike sort of these types of mechanics, which I'm not necessarily sure this would qualify, but anywhere where you can like lose a ton of progress if you fuck up too bad, like there's a way to do that that works, and there's a way to do that that just makes it feel like kind of disrespectful of the time that I'm trying to invest in it.
Sure, yeah.
I think it's a very, very good game, and it's highly lauded, but I just don't, I find myself bouncing off of it the first time I have a run where I'm like, well, I fucked up and I have to start over.
Yeah. No, that's fair. It is punishing, more punishing than a lot of roguelikes. And I think it's, again, hard. You have to wrap your head around, like, I don't care about these people. I just care about my town. And with that in mind, what can I do to, like, further enhance my town, even if it means dying a bunch? But, yeah.
I played an interesting one, and I will admit, I didn't sink a ton of time into this, but I did play quite a few rounds and really dug it. It's called SOS. Are you familiar?
I am familiar. I've watched a lot of video of it trying to get it streamable, but I don't think we could ever stream it.
No, it's rough. So like, okay, so basic premise is it's sort of it's stylized like a TV show. You have, I should talk about mechanically first. So there's 16 people dropped onto an island. And on this island, there are these 5 relics that you can collect. You have to get a successful run means finding one of these relics, calling in a chopper, and then getting off the island. And while you're on the island, you're kind of scrambling, looking for weapons or ammo or, you know, health, that kind of thing. And there are animals and monsters on the island that you have to deal with. 16 people all dropped off at different points. And the interesting thing about it that keeps it from being really similar at all from like a, it may sound like a battle royale mixed with like dust or what have you. But the thing that makes it really different is it really encourages social play in a way that I think is really cool. Like when you find someone, you can start an alliance by raising your hand, and if they raise their hand also, and the two of you high five, you're immediately like joined into an alliance. There mm-hmm. are there's a walkie-talkie with different channels on it, and people in your alliance can like all decide that they're going to go on a different channel, and use the walkie-talkie to stay in communication. Or if you're close to people, you can talk to them that way. So it creates a lot of these really tense moments where like you see someone coming at you and you have to make a really quick decision. Like, well, am I going to befriend this person? Are they going to try to befriend me? Are they going to try to get close and then put me down? It's really tricky. And
there's like an audience sponsor element to it too, right?
Yeah. So when you die, or you can just join the audience one way, like just join the audience, or when you die, you're placed in the audience, and you can actually award players for not great technical play, like not great skill gameplay, but great performance. And you build like a reputation for how good your performance is. So like, and every time I played, the vast majority, almost everybody, was using a microphone. And like, there's an introductory sequence, right, where it goes person to person and the camera like focuses in on each player for like 3 seconds, and it tells you when your time is going to come up, and then you get like 3 seconds to just like pitch who you are, like what your thing is. And there are a lot of people who are playing like actual real characters. I was in a game once where a guy was just acting like the Joker, which was very unnerving because we were all working together, and this guy's like, I'll be fine with the relic, you can trust me, like very creepy and fun. And it does a lot of cool stuff, like it tracks what kind of player you are. So when you get introduced, it says like, you're not very loyal, like you turn on people, or you're very generous, like you give to people a lot. And if there's two players in a game, which I saw several times, two players in a game where one of them turned on the other one, they will actually get a little moment where it's like the two of them standing across the fire from one another, where they can like kind of talk to each other. It's like, last game, what's his face betrayed this guy, and like they can talk about it for a second. So you get to see like, oh shit, it's you.
That's I'm so totally good. Gonna.
It's so good.
What percentage of what you've played has been like horrible slurs?
So the interesting thing about it is, I saw like none of that. There are some people who I would say their portrayal is maybe a little tone deaf.
Problematic
portrayals. Yeah. But because it's not really a game of like, how good are you at shooting or what have you, like the game is playing that role. Like, it's really, there's no point to playing it. Like, it doesn't attract the sort of people, I think, that would just get on there to grief.
You are incentivized actively to not be a dickhead.
Exactly. Or if you're going to be a dickhead, like, be a dickhead in character. Like, it is not telling everybody to be good guys. You can be a total scumbag, but you do have to be like a consistent character of a scumbag.
Yeah, sure.
How close does this get to being the Survivor video game adaptation that you've always wanted?
The pluses are that people are really good with everybody using the voice chat. I plugged in my headset, and I didn't even have it plugged in at first because, like, I'm a human being and I live on the internet. So, like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do voice chat. But everybody is. Like, it would be weird to not play this game with voice chat. I think that you would probably just end up, you would be at a real deficit because you wouldn't be able to sort of, like, wheel and deal. The games that I saw, like, I saw fairly consistently, like, people who were in an alliance, and then there's only 3 seats on the chopper. So yeah. If you have 4 people working together, like, something's going to happen. Like, somebody's going to...
That's that Survivor shit. Like,
somebody's going to get got.
Yeah. I've not checked this one out, but I really want to. Real quick before we move on for like 30 seconds, because we're going to talk about this again in a couple months. The Sea of Thieves beta was fucking fantastic. I still want to know like what the sort of continuing progression loops really feel like, if that's going to hook me, and hopefully they will add some more enemies, like NPC enemies, because killing skeletons over and over again is apparently not especially entertaining. I guess the Kraken is in there somewhere. We just like never found it while we were sailing around, but we streamed it a couple times in like big groups, and I played it a couple times by myself on like a one person ship, and just sailing around that game is so good.
Like, I've not, I mean, wave wise there's never been more realistic water effects ever.
Well, like it's in yes, and managing that by yourself when you're on like a one person ship is really exciting, because you are just running around the ship like making little corrections here and there to try to get your ship as going as smooth as possible. But working with a full crew of four people, and like having one person steering and one person on the front of the ship making sure you're not going to run into anything, and one person on the map downstairs making sure you're going in the right direction, and one person raising and lowering sails and turning them in the correct direction to catch the wind, is like, it is so fun. And when it clicks, it feels like nothing I've ever really played before. Like, it genuinely feels like you are out on open water, just like working together to do this difficult thing. It is so fun.
Felt great. It actually kind of reminded me of a Destiny raid a little bit, insofar as everyone had very disparate tasks, but everyone was working for a greater good and had to be very vocally coordinating with one another. So I thought it was awesome.
But again, well, I think it comes out in March, so we'll dive into it more then. Who wants to start, or does somebody else have another?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Unless someone has another honorable mention. Nope. Three, two, one. Okay. Celeste is the game that I'm going to talk about. Celeste is a game made by Matt Thorson, who made a game that I believe I really, really tried to get to win besties like 3 years ago, which was Towerfall.
It probably should have. I forget what beat it. Like, probably Dishonored or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds very besties. So Matt made this game. In Towerfall, there was actually a lot of platforming stuff, like weird like trial challenges and stuff like that, and you could tell that he was kind of stretching his experience insofar as he wanted to bring some of the stuff he learned from Towerfall and the platforming in that game to an entirely focused platforming game, which is Celeste. It is a 2D, I want to say like 16-bit looking platforming game, where you play as this hiker that is trying to climb up a mountain, and to that end you basically just have an air dash and a jump and the ability to like climb up vertical surfaces, and that's it. And like any good platformer, it slowly but surely introduces different mechanics, whether that's as simple as like a trampoline or as complicated as like a piece of energy that you can pick up and then suddenly you can fly in any direction for a few seconds. So like as a platformer, I think it's like a very well designed, very smartly designed platformer. It's very hard, but not punishingly so. I think just about anyone could get through it without using the included assist mode, which makes the game like super, super easy.
That gives you like infinite air dashes and makes it so that you just bounce when you hit a pit at the bottom of the screen.
I'm sure there are people that like, actually I know Allegra, for example, on staff, used that because she found the platforming to be too stressful, and that's fine. Like, if you want to do that, that's totally reasonable. Because
the game itself is kind of cool. Like, this story of your character and why they're climbing the mountain and the things they learn as they climb it and the people they meet is like, it's actually like, there's a lot of game there. It's not just like a dialogue-free platformer. Like, it has something to say.
Right. That was, I think, the biggest standout element for me, apart from like gorgeous graphics and really great score. It did something that like most raw platformers do not even attempt, which is to have a story, to have interesting characters, to have like depth on that front. So I thought that was absolutely excellent. They really did an amazing job there. I know Plant, you played a lot of it. What was your sort of take?
I like how forgiving it is. I mean, I don't know how to sound this without sounding like a jerk. I felt like it was a surprisingly easy game, but this is, I think, coming from having played a lot of Massacre games, and I never felt like there was that much of a challenge until maybe the end and the B-sides.
Those B-sides, man.
The B-sides are real. But the thing that I did not appreciate on my own was all of the what are the alternate controls called, Fresh? The forgiveness controls?
Assist mode?
Assist mode?
The assist mode. Like, how much that has helped other people play it who I've recommended it to. And I've seen the sheer variety of assist mode is what I think is really impressive. Because I have seen some people on our team play it with infinite jumps. I've seen some people play it who just changed that the speed of the game helped a lot, like bumping it to 80%. And the ability to kind of like alter it when you need it and get rid of it when you don't is really interesting. And I think in some ways it makes a lot of sense because the way the strawberries, especially if you're playing for like earning the little strawberries throughout the stage,
they're like meaningless, like pickups, meaningless. Just to show off, like, hey, I got 80 strawberries.
But I at first I was like, oh well, what's the point of the strawberries if you have assist mode? But what I realized is so much of the strawberries are kind of like puzzles where
you
figure out how to do it, and then sometimes your skill can't match it, but you know how to do it. And assist mode, I think, lets people kind of solve those puzzles and enjoy like that discovery without feeling like, oh, well, I just don't have these absurdly developed reflexes from being a total shut-in like myself and everybody on this call.
The pacing and structure of the game is so smart and so digestible where basically you only need to put in like perfect inputs, especially, and I'm talking about like the B sides. The regular game is a little bit more forgiving, but some of the levels are really difficult, especially when you're being like chased by essentially an enemy that if it touches you, you die. You basically have to be on point during that. But the pacing of the game is really digestible because each room really only takes like 20 seconds or so of like really or less of really good platforming to clear. And if you die, you just start at the beginning of that room and you can there's like a checkpoint system. So if you miss something, you can just hop back in to whatever like section of each level you want to get into. And it's really fun just like doing attempt after attempt of a room until you find that perfect, 15, 20 seconds that you need to complete it. Like that loop is really satisfying and not super punishing either.
Right. That ability to restart, like, I don't know. So when I was playing it through the first time, it seems obvious at this point, the instant restart mechanic for these games. But on the flip side, I've been playing Descenders, which I can't go a ton into, but I think I can speak about it like in a preview sense that is coming out, I don't know, around the time that this episode will go live. And for people who don't know it, it's by the people who did Action Hank. It is this downhill off-road biking game, and it's really, really fun. But one of the downsides is it's incredibly punishing for when you screw up, as in you can reverse your progress. So if you are just trying to learn it or you want to take like a really big risk and do a wild jump and you eat up your lives on a round going down the mountain, your character can actively get worse.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, your XP,
that's crazy.
It goes in the opposite direction. So there's like a mode where you can turn that off and practice, but it just feels really bizarre to have that on really hardcore games. And I like I said, it seems like an assumed thing, but it is not. It is very much a choice that I think Matt made that pays off really well and makes you never feel terrible. Same with making strawberries not mandatory.
Yeah, and it being on Switch, again, like, I feel like despite the fact the Switch has been out for a year now, like, it's worth saying, like, it's perfect. Like, it is a perfect game for Switch, especially in these little digestible chunks. It is a really nice game to just, like, pick up and start, trying to knock out a few rooms and then put it back down. And you just come right back to it.
Just speaking of the B-sides for a second, because I do agree, like, the main game is not that hard. It's probably, like, 6-7 hours, I would say, for most people. One of the B-sides took me the entire length of 500 Days of Summer, which was on, I just left it on Netflix as I was playing it on the couch, and I was just stuck on this same, I died 200 times on the same level. So I like the fact that the B-sides like are separate, there's not an obligation to do them. I like that they're super hard and they give people that massacre like itch. The only thing that I kind of critique in terms of the difficulty and game structure is that when you beat the game, there's a level that's locked. And the only way to unlock that level is to get 4 crystal hearts, which are these hearts that are, you know, they're collectibles, essentially. And the most obvious way to get hearts is to finish B-sides. There are also hidden hearts throughout the levels that are, you know, off the beaten path and pretty tough to find. So technically, if you don't have, like, extreme platforming skill, you could still get these crystal hearts. But this last level that's locked is actually one of the best, if not my favorite level in the game. And it's kind of weird that it would be so inaccessible to most people. I think a lot of people will, like, get to the end and be like, I didn't see a single crystal heart. I'm just going to stop now. And so that was kind of a weird choice. But overall, I think it's a great game.
Cool. Who wants to go next?
I'll go. The game that I am bringing this month is called Subnautica. And this is one that I kind of picked up a little bit on a whim, just because there'd been a lot of discussion about it sort of before it was released. And I think it finally came out of early access.
It's been in early access for like 2 years.
It's been a long time. So basically, it's a sort of survival crafting sort of thing, not unlike, I know I referenced it earlier, but this is a better comparison of like Dust or...
Rust.
Yeah, Rust. Not Dust.
Dust is the anime Metroidvania.
Right. And the, like, CCP first-person shooter, right?
Yes.
So Rust, or Minecraft or what have you, not really that much like Minecraft. So you're dropped off in the middle of the ocean. You have a base that is really just a floating escape pod that has within it a crafting station and some storage and a radio that you get occasional transmissions to, and you're dropped off with very little guidance as to what to do. It's very much your only impetus is sort of exploration. You see a giant ship in the background that you might be able to access, but that looks like the ship that crashed and dropped you off of it. But that's really your only waypoint, and really the only charge to you at the beginning is to sort of explore and expand your capabilities to explore. And that happens through, I guess, a loop that's fairly traditional for games like this. You go and look for items that are going to increase your ability to survive, or for example, you need water and food so you can swim after little animals and fish that are swimming through the ocean and grab them and then take them back to your base. And one of the fish you can turn into bottles of water, and the rest you can cook up and eat. There are plants that can be turned into rubber or minerals that you find in the ocean that you can use to build new equipment, like a new tank that lets you stay underwater longer. And as you sort of progress, it is a very satisfying, I think more than any of these I've ever played. It is, while it gives you very little guidance, it's very easy to sort of create goals for yourself that feel really meaningful. Like, today I'm going to go out and make myself one of these little hovercrafts, and there are like a bunch of different items you need to find to get it together. But like swimming through the ocean, trying to find the stuff you need to put those together is really pleasurable and really encourages like experimentation. It tells you very little, like in terms of, hey, you should try this now. And you're really left to your own devices, but it's really easy to say like, oh, cool, like better flippers to help me swim fast. That's neat. I'm going to go figure that out. And it's not really that inscrutable in terms of finding this stuff. It's really about like just kind of poking around for it. And the whole time you're like avoiding sea life that is a huge threat to you, and, you know, trying to manage your water and hunger levels.
This sounds a lot like No Man's Sky. Is that
okay? So yes.
The good thing, though, is unlike No Man's Sky, you can turn off most of those things that you're required to do. Like, you can basically just oxygen. That's how I'm playing it. And it is.
You can. Here's what I'm going to say.
Yes.
So I think the comparison to No Man's Sky is very accurate. I think this game does what No Man's Sky was trying to do so much better than No Man's Sky did, which is to say it makes progression and exploration feel very satisfying, as Justin alluded to. I personally think that the survival stuff is not so incapacitating. And I kind of...
It's pretty benign.
It's not like frustrating to the point where you're constantly starving or needing water and stuff like that.
You would be well served, though. I think, at least, I kind of agree with Chris. I wish I had done this, but I've gone too far down the rabbit hole. You can turn off water and food concerns, and I think that's like very legit way to play, and I would recommend it, because it's like, it's not that, it's the same stuff, but I mean, there's ways to make it a little better, but like, by and large, it's go out and grab some fish and turn them into food and water.
You just go faster. The thing that I really was amazed by was that, like, at the start, I was expecting, like, No Man's Sky, like, oh, well, whatever, you have a base and you craft stuff. And I was surprised at, like, how many mechanics slowly get layered in to make it a much more complex experience. Like, I thought, oh, whatever, it's pretty straightforward. And then they start adding base building and ship creation and, like, all sorts of stuff that they only, like, alluded to at the beginning, but really was not the reason you were there. It's I think they did an amazing job.
And it really and to honestly, the No Man's Sky thing had not even occurred to me, but I guess it is sort of legit. The other thing I would say, though, is that exploration in No Man's Sky really boiled down a lot of the time to something boring. Like, you find another boring thing. In this game, when you find something new, it's like a lot of times, and being underwater helps with that, because I find that really sort of like awesome in the literal sense of the word and terrifying. But like, when you find a new place in Subnautica, it can be like, oh shit, like this is really one of the first times I was in that deep water, I came across skyscraper-sized fish so big that you could harvest stuff off of the top of its shell, and it was terrifying. I took a wrong turn in a cave while I was looking for something and found a huge cavern full of glowing pink mushrooms the size of Buicks. And like, if you want to explore that stuff, you want to go find those things, and you get these beacons that are basically alerts or messages from people that have also crashed, and you get beacons alerting you to where they are, and those often lead to like new tech that you can build out, like build a little mini sub or something like that, or you can they'll lead you to like little story kind of things, but like it helps to guide and push things along.
Juice, do you know if the map is like procedurally generated at all? Or is it handmade?
The map. I think it's handmade.
Obviously is part of the reason why it sort of stands out. You know, if you're handcrafting something, obviously it's going to be much more identifiable. I was wondering about that just because you're right. Like, No Man's Sky, like, once you've been to six planets, you've seen everything there is to offer it. Not to mention, like, the animals start getting redundant. But here I was like, there was a fish that was like looking at me, and then I heard my my suit computer go like, "You should approach that fish," and it was like pulling me in. And once I got close enough, I saw the fish was called a mesmer, and it was like hypnotizing me to approach it so that it could eat my face off. Like, that is freaking cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
They do such a good job.
It's really neat. Like, there's so many cool little vignettes, and like, I really liked the loop of upgrading stuff. It felt very satisfying to me. I really enjoyed it.
I just Googled also, apparently there's a VR version, which I would be very curious to check out.
The main version you can play in VR. I didn't have the balls to try it.
Yeah. I didn't have the setup for it currently, but
it sounds kind of perfect for it though. Like, this sounds exactly like my favorite type of game here. This sounds really good.
I've read about some people bouncing off of it, and I think it's because it doesn't necessarily walk you in very well. But if you enjoy that idea of like exploring the ocean, I think it's like it has a great sense of like you get this in Minecraft sometimes with like these survival things, like, oh man, I am, and you never got this with No Man's Sky. this sense of like, oh, I'm out way too far.
Yeah.
I should not be here. And like, there's something about having that feeling underneath the ocean where it's like, oh, like I am really, really boned at this exact moment and I got to find a way to get back. But there's some cool stuff that I really want to look at down there. So maybe I'll push this a little bit farther. But I really dug it.
Yeah, it's freaking awesome.
Russ, you mentioned you had something for halftime. And when you say that, I need you to know my anxiety spikes.
Pretty well, this is just me. This is there's no one joining us this week. I just
and when you say so, when you say that, like the anxiety spike, I need you to know, my friend, does not get any more shallow because I've been fooled like more times than I can count, and each one hurts really bad.
As far as I'm aware, it's just me. I had a bit of a situation yesterday regarding hot wings that I wanted to share with you guys.
Perfect.
Right, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, the amount of butt related material I'm about to endure.
No butt related material.
Okay.
I mean, I had butt related, but that was not the focus.
I regularly get texts from Russ about his poops. I mean, I don't mean that as a joke. I mean, like, every couple of weeks, if Russ has an exceptional dookie, I'll get a text about it.
Yeah, well, yeah, either pro or con. Hashtag, but in this case, no.
Hashtag Pringles.
So I went to Buffalo Wild Wings, a local establishment in my town here, to procure some wings for the Super Bowl. Now, I went a day early.
Because everybody loves day old wings for the big game.
No, I went a day early to put the order in because I knew how much demand there would be on Super Bowl night. I was having people over. I wanted to have wings. So I was very responsible and put the order in early. I showed up at 5:30, and I want you to picture Buffalo Wild Wings is like, in case people aren't aware, it's like a sports bar. There must be
McDonald's,
people that have never
in case
been.
You aren't aware, they sell hamburgers and fries.
Is really that many people have been into Buffalo Wild Wings?
If you've watched a sporting event, you've seen like a trillion VW3.
Sure. Well, imagine that Buffalo, the TV-friendly Buffalo Wild Wings that you've seen on television.
Got it.
But on the inside, it's the Thunderdome because the wings, all wings, have been delayed by 2.5 hours.
Oh my God.
There is a crowd. They have people in a pen. So there's the normal restaurant part of Buffalo Wild Wings. And then off to the corner, there is a pen with seating like the DMV for about 30 to 35 people. There are about 60 people crowded into this pen, all with receipts, all screaming in Queens accents at poor people working there saying, where the fuck are my wings? What's going on? It is absolute fucking mayhem. Okay, so I put my order in. It was supposed to be ready at 5:30. They are like, come back at 6:15. Meanwhile, I have people coming to my house at 5:45, figuring this is all going to go smoothly. So I leave. I get my wife to hold down the fort, and I come back 45 minutes later. The crowd has doubled. It's like people are out the door screaming, yelling, kicking. This is not Philadelphia. No one cares about the Super Bowl. This is just about wings. It is total chaos. Okay. In front of all these people that are in this pen, there are bags, plastic bags, piled high with other orders. Now, these are orders that have not been picked up yet.
Did you witness Buffalo wing theft, Russ Freshtick?
I might have committed.
Did you
Buffalo.
No, Russ Freshtick. Russ Freshtick.
Okay, let me lay it out. I'm going to lay out the situation and see if you think I did the wrong thing.
Yes.
Can I answer now? Do we have to wait to the end to answer, or can we answer now?
You can answer now, and maybe you'll regret it.
You did the wrong thing. I'm not going to regret it. Go ahead.
Okay. So let's also keep in mind, I have 8 to 10 people in my apartment waiting to eat.
Don't
there's
try
no
to
food
justify your crime there, Jean Valjean. I needed the Buffalo Wild Wings to feed my family.
Okay, so I go back there. All the tickets are out. There's probably like, 15, 20 like bags just sitting in the front of the table. Now, each of the bags are labeled based on what time they were supposed to be picked up. Mine for 5:30, obviously. But there was another bag that was labeled 4 p.m. And it had been there for 2 hours and had about what my order was, give or take. 50 wings, mango and sweet barbecue. Ugh. Close enough. So
you just
you got a little confused. You got a little confused. Wink, wink. You got a little confused about which was yours. Was that was that the excuse that you created in your head for when somebody's like, "Hey, get that nerd."
What about the additional details of that story that you just told us made you think that I would then think it was an acceptable thing to do? The fact that it was close to the mango, right?
And B, I would say, I don't know if you're aware, Griffin, but there is a food crisis on this earth. And whenever I hear of food being wasted, a tear rolls down my eye.
Yeah, but you're not you're not food Batman. This person's going to show up looking for their thing, and they're not going
to... Are they going to show up? They were supposed to show up 2 hours before to pick up their wings.
I mean, New York City traffic, baby, best in the world.
what?
Yeah, that's a good accent. So, like, they're not going to know unless you left a note like, "Hey, Jim, if the bat comes out for Russ Freshtek, you did theft and you did a crime." And the fact you're bragging about it kind of disgusts me.
I'm not bragging about it. I'm saying, what would you do? What would you do?
Oh, I would wait politely for my wings that they made for me with love and care and attention for me, Griffin, to be ready, not steal.
But they're 2 hours late.
That doesn't matter. It's still...
There's an entire group of people in my apartment that I care a lot more about than random person that didn't pick up their wings for 2 hours.
Oh, I see. It's an act of charity, really. If you really boil it down.
I'm a giver.
He cared too much.
Yeah, that's his problem. All right, well, I'm going to call the cops.
Turns out the wings were too spicy and I got a tummy ache.
Well, that's God
for you. So that's karma.
Yeah. I've called the cops. They'll be there soon.
I actually had a similar tragic story, though mine, I'm the victim. we were worried about a similar thing over at City's parents' house. So we actually ordered our pizza at like 4, assuming it's going to be a shit show. It's going to take that 4 would be the latest.
4 the same day, right?
4 o'clock the same day. I guess it's going to be a couple hours.
So you were
even
less responsible than me. Sure.
We'll eat at 6. And the pizza arrived at 4:45.
Oh,
and
no.
It was tragic because I can't imagine. I'm going to get choked up. I can't remember a time in my life when I've ever seen pizza being delivered and thought, not yet. You know, what I mean? Like, I've never thought like, a little too soon. I've never met that moment with anything other than just like sheer
relief
and delight. And I had this experience where I was like, pizza, not yet. What? It was heartbreaking. Even the Eagles win, and you know how much I love football. Even the Eagles win was no balm for it. It was really a tragedy.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
Chris and I are bringing very similar games now that I think about it. Do you want to go first? Or you want me to?
You can go first.
All right. So I'm bringing Monster Hunter World, which is a game I've been looking forward to for a long time. Basically, since I think they announced it last year at some point. I remember seeing a presentation for it at E3 and being very excited for it, and then it just kind of snuck up on me because it came out last Friday or the Friday before last. If you have not played a Monster Hunter game, quick pitch is it's a game all about these big boss fights where you take down these monsters, you pursue them and locate them in these various territories, and the territories are full of other sort of endemic smaller creatures and resources that you can gather. And then when you find the monster, you have a big fight with them, big, very technical, very sort of precision requiring fight that if you are successful in, you get to carve them up, or you can capture them, and then you get their parts, and you can use those parts to craft or upgrade weapons and armor, and then rinse and repeat, basically. As the fights get harder, the monsters get bigger, and you progress down sort of the story or unlock new optional hunts that you can go after just for more resources that you can use on your gear. And that loop exists in some way in most RPGs, right? Especially these days where there's every fucking game has crafting in it, basically, at this point. But Monster Hunter was early in this sort of pursuit, and in various points in the franchise, this loop has been anywhere from like almost completely incomprehensible and player unfriendly and punishing and shitty to where it is now in Monster Hunter World, which is, in my opinion, like actually very approachable and very fun. I started playing with Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate, which was the 3DS game that came out, 5 or so years ago, and then I got really into Generations, the other 3DS game, and then this is the third one I've played, and the thing that really stands out, first of all, it looks and plays fucking fantastic.
It is very pretty.
Like, playing this game at 60 frames a second is, like, really something else, because I know people are kind of tired of the Souls comparison, but that is a game all about these big boss animations and player animations being, like, flawless in this 60 frame window, where everything has such a good feel because of that, and Monster Hunter World really benefits because of that. Like, it feels really really good to play. There's 14 different weapon types, and, like, each one, that's, like, the main decision you make, because each one handles differently and is sort of equivalent to, like, how you pick a class in another sort of class-based RPG. And for the first time, like, I want to play all 14 weapons, because they are all, like, a lot of fun in very, very different ways. But on top of all that stuff, the thing that Monster Hunter World really brings to the table is dozens and dozens of these quality of life improvements to make that pursuit of finding a mission or joining a multiplayer mission, finding the monster you need to fight, killing it, and then getting the stuff you need to make new stuff, like, so much easier than it has been in the past. I cannot stress it enough. Like, one big example is in past Monster Hunter games, once you sort of, there's, like, a central hub, and that exists in World too, but whenever you go out on a mission from that central hub, at that point, your equipment loadout is locked. Your item loadout is locked. There is no way to, like, change what weapon you want to use.
I saw a tooltip that said you could change it in camp.
Yeah.
And
you can do that in World now. That is what I'm saying. And if you go back to camp, Monster Hunter World, there's a little tent. You just pop into your tent. Yeah.
All right.
But that's a big improvement. Like, in past games, you spend some money to, like, buy a meal, and you eat that meal to, like, get a buff, and then maybe you spend some money to purchase the right to go out on a quest. Another thing that World has done away with. And then you go out on the quest and you realize, like, oh shit, I brought the wrong weapon. Well, abandon quest. Let's start over. And in World, like, you don't have to do that. It drastically cuts down the need to go back to that central hub. Even if you complete the mission, you can just pop right back to the starting zone of the area you were in and just jump right into another mission. It is so much faster and so much better than it ever has been.
This is what makes this game such a vast improvement. Like, whetstones, which it used to be a resource that you would use to sharpen your weapon, which you have to do a lot, is now just a permanent item that you can use as many times as you want to. Tracking is huge. Like, you used to randomly find the monster and then throw this thing called a paint berry at it. Did you remember to bring paint berries? I hope you did, because you have to throw a paint berry at it, and then you can track the monster on the map. But also, the getting around the map is inscrutable, and also the paint berries wear off after a certain amount of time, so, like, you have to remember when you see the monster, like, how long has it been since I threw the paint berry at them? I better throw another one just to be sure. Like, miserable. And now you have little flies that when you tell it, I want to see this monster, they will fly to it. But, like, and they will show you a glittering path directly to the monster. But the thing that's cool about it is that it isn't just like nerfed. It isn't just like, well, this is easy now. When you're in the world, you find things like monster tracks and scales and stuff like that that actually improves your scout flies, which is what that's called. It improves their ability to find the monsters. So, like, you do need to be smart and thorough and, like an actual hunter, like, learn how to track this stuff before that stuff improves. It's hugely improved.
In past games, there were no, like, footprints you find. There were no trails to follow. And so in doing this, I don't think it's a nerfed thing at all. I think it's more like hunting. Like, there's a lot of stuff about this that feels like hunting, because while there are a bunch of quality and life improvements to make things that were annoying, just annoying for no reason before, a lot easier, especially for the late game hunts, you have to be fully prepared. Like, a lot of the time I've spent playing the game, I actually finished the main story of it last night, like, towards the end of the game, a lot of the stuff you're going to be doing is not actually going out on the hunts for the monsters you need to kill. It's going out on hunts to get the stuff that you need, the armor and weapons that you need to kill the monsters you're going to kill. Because if you just run into it with the same loadout used for everything else, you are going to get massacred.
Okay, so here's so Griffin's obviously, like, an old master at this. Justin has not really enjoyed a Monster Hunter game until this one. Is that fair to say, Justin?
Yes, and I have tried. I've had people who know the game literally looking over my shoulder.
This past E3 was me and Pat Gill doing local multiplayer sessions of Generations with Justin. Like, okay, so you get your paint berry out, and then and didn't work.
And they weren't frustrated with me. Like Pat's final thing when I gave up was like, yeah, it is like that. It is. It is. Yeah.
So I guess the question here was like, when you started playing World, was Griffin like over your shoulder walking you through it?
No. I didn't even have to Google at first, which is wild because I was doing that constantly with Monster Hunter. If you pay attention to what it's telling you and like don't get obsessed about all the things that you don't understand, just focus on the things that like you need to understand, like and not worry about additional systems until you need an edge. Or you're bored and you want to like vary what you're doing. Like, I don't think that you need.
Yeah. Those things that are a little bit more complex are like percentiles of support on top of your skill or whatever. Like the bulk of the game is finding a weapon that clicks for you and then using it to kill monsters. And if that's all you do, that should get you where you need to be, especially in the early, like low rank stuff. But once things start getting a little bit tougher, then you do need to kind of drill down into some stuff.
I wonder, Justin, whether you would have had the same experience had you not had that like hand-holdy experience with the other Monster Hunter game, because I played this essentially, I played like for a half hour, 45 minutes alone, and have never really played a Monster Hunter game before, and I found it like extremely overwhelming in terms of like the HUD and the mechanics and everything, to the point where like I definitely, in order to try it again, would need a guide, either a physical person talking to me or reading online. Because, like, a lot of it, although it made sense to me, I found it just, like, in the way that, like, when you play an RPG and you get a health potion and you never use that health potion because you're like, I want to save this for the next time I really need it. Like, I felt like I was getting 30 items every time I did anything and didn't know when to use them or should I use them or what they even did.
Yeah, here's the thing.
That's legit. To answer your question, Russ, I think that is probably a factor. Stuff like there are things that definitely carry over, that like sharpness is a good thing of like there's a meter on the screen that shows that your weapon is getting dull, and like there that's like a carryover that I probably internalized, and definitely some like the weapons feel similar enough that I remembered from last time.
The thing about Monster Hunter is it is not like any other game, and it's that reason why I think it is kind of like a game you should really play, and a game, even if you don't like it, a game you should check out and become sort of literate in, because
you mentioned the
RPG thing, getting a bunch of potions and items and shit and not really knowing when to use them, so you don't use them. That is my experience in virtually every RPG. But the thing about Monster Hunter is when it was like created, the idea was like, what if we did that, but you had to use every, like you did not have that option, because the answer to your question is like, you don't know when to use your potions or whatever. Like the answer is, like right now, is it like when you need to, if you are about to die, use those items, do not be sparing about it. But it has like a pace that is unlike any other game. Like sometimes you're just gonna have to go out on resource runs and go collect some stuff, and maybe when you go out to like collect some stuff that you might need to make a, you know, a stockpile of potions, you might find like a rare gem while you're mining, and then I'm gonna pop back to the base and see what I can craft with that. So it's not just like mindless farming. Like there are these constant hooks that will open up new sort of avenues for you in all these different directions in a way that I think is like is really exciting. Like my whole jam, and if you've listened to this podcast before, you probably know this, is like really solid RPG progression hooks, and I am hard pressed to think of a game that does this better than Monster Hunter, because it's just, that's entirely what it's about. One huge improvement is there's now a wish list. So while you're at the armory and you're looking at like the different stuff you can craft down the line, if you see something really good that you want to craft, you can put it on your wish list. And then anytime you collect a thing that goes towards those things, it shows up as like an objective that you are working toward, which is a really, really smart way of just constantly displaying those hooks. And then like, it's not all farming and grinding, though, because the payoff for that stuff is phenomenal. Like, the last few boss fights in the game are these white knuckle for a half hour. It sustains this like white knuckle, terrifying, if I fuck up once, I'm dead pace that if you did not put in the work to like prep for, you are going to lose. But then when you pull it off, it's like all that work then accumulates in this like hugely satisfying moment. That is like unlike anything in games. And that's always been true about Monster Hunter. But on top of that, there have been these layers and layers and layers of bullshit that literally exist for no reason at all. They are just annoyances. And if you talk to even the franchise's like most devoted fans, it's like, okay, so here's like the 10 annoying things you got to know. And it's going to suck every time. But you do that, and then you do these awesome boss fights, and you get these great payoffs. And now a lot of that stuff has been sort of skimmed off. I would encourage everybody to watch. Pat did a beginner's guide video on Monster Hunter, which, because again, like some of the loops are a bit arcane. He did a 10 minute long video that sort of walks you through sort of what you will be doing when you play the game, because I feel like when you're just dropped in this huge world, and it is a huge world with tons of stuff to do, it does feel like if you don't know what's up, you're gonna just be stumbling around for a while, unsure of which direction to go. And a video like that is gonna really, really give you at least like the first few stepping stones you need before things fall into place.
Yeah, for sure.
But it's a great game. Like I'm in love with it. And
for grindy games like that, I feel like I would be, I mean, as we routinely say on this podcast these days, if it was on Switch and I could like play it while like half watching Netflix, I think it'd be much easier to like grok. But the fact that I'm like sitting down staring at a TV and trying to learn these systems makes it feel like a little more time investing than I'd want to right now. But I also know, like, given the fact that Monster Hunter as a franchise is not going away, I just want to like get it. Like, I want to understand it.
I also just wonder if maybe your relationship with it will be similar to what my relationship was with the Dark Souls, with Demon Souls, then Dark Souls, then Bloodborne. You bounce off of it enough times, but each time you learn a little bit more of the thing, so that at a certain point you hop on and it clicks. And I kind of feel like a number of people I've seen hop on Monster Hunter this time are people who tried other versions of it and had done some of that legwork. And now it's like, oh, well, I've done the legwork, and this time I can skip that part of the learning phase.
Yeah, I think that makes
also
sense.
Multiplayer was kind of rough the first like weekend that the game was out, but it's actually really very streamlined now, and like the community is for the most part pretty good. And like I've hit a point where now like helping people out is kind of the main thing I can do, aside from like going for a few last big pieces of gear. So I would be happy to go on hunts with you, because this game really shines in multiplayer.
How are these games supported? Like, I hear of people playing like 200 hours.
Yeah, there's like, what are you doing? Just keep unlocking like higher, more difficult tiers of mostly the same monsters that you've already taken
but
down.
They're blue now.
Yeah, and getting stronger so that you can like make it a lot faster for you to take those monsters out is just a nonstop pursuit. But again, that's not really anything new. That is like, you know, Destiny end game, any RPG with an end game thing.
Totally.
Yeah. Speaking of big monsters.
Let's talk about Shadow of the Colossus, a game that didn't come out this month, but we reviewed on Polygon.com this month.
And also, Chris is about to leave forever.
Yeah, I'm going to be gone for a month. I don't know if I'll be here during February. Maybe I will. We'll see. But I want to talk about this just in case, because it is a very, very, very good game. So yeah, it is a, I don't know, remake, remaster thing by an Austin studio, Blue Point Games, and
I didn't know they made this.
What? Yeah. They're very talented. And it plays exactly like the PlayStation 2 Shadow of the Colossus. There are some tweaks there to make it a little more enjoyable. There's a refined control scheme option that like changes where the button, oh my gosh, where the jump button is. I am like really falling all over myself today. And they say that to navigate this big open world, you like hold your sword to the sky, and if it's in sunlight, it points to where you need to go. They say that that has been refined. I did not have that experience at all. There were still a number of times where the way it kind of branches out to fights is there's a big central open space, and then you kind of get go down these paths, and you have to choose the right one. And I, on more than one occasion, went down the wrong path and lost probably 10 minutes just wandering, which isn't so bad because it's a very beautiful open world.
Also, your character's name Wander, so like that's appropriate.
What? Really?
And what's the name of the horse?
I didn't know that.
Arrow.
Argo.
Argo.
Is that what is that, Russ?
That's what they sound like. I guess
he's just like a because he doesn't speak any known language. It's like a made up language.
Every time he goes,
and whenever he,
oh my gosh, I think you are listening to some bad speakers.
I mean, when I last played it, to give you an idea, it was on a PS2, and I was playing it on a CRT TV.
I can't stop thinking about how this also got a PS. I'm looking at the PS3 remaster that came out. Are they just gonna keep on doing these?
But this is a total redux, right? This is not.
That's the weird thing about it is, if you go back and you actually like watch the PS2 version, or if you can try your best to remember playing it on a CRTV, it has this weird effect where that game, because of all the technical limitations, the textures were very low res. You couldn't make out like facial features on your character. Everything kind of had this washy vibe. They overlit everything so it'd blow out the light in the distance. That way, you didn't have to load things. So it was very, it was this very like blown out bright game. And then you play this version of the game, which in the review, I compared it to like 1980s fantasy films. It kind of looks like Labyrinth or Neverending Story. So very, very realistic. But at the same time, fantastical. But it's weird how much a game feels different when you shift the graphics that much. And that it's strange to say that because they tried to recreate the PS2 thing. It's not like they completely changed the art style, but by virtue of the power, like having the power to make a game look realistic, it has a huge impact. And the thing that I found this time around is it felt very fairy tale like when I played it on the PS2. Yeah. And when you play it now, it feels grimier and in a weird way sadder. Like it didn't feel quite as much of like a like playing a metaphor. It felt like, oh, this is a person. And it hit me in a different way. I don't know. I find that really exciting that you can play, that we have the opportunity to play both the games, and that they're somehow different, even though like what's happening underneath the skin is like literally the exact same.
Well, so first of all, I want to say like you can play it at 60 frames per second. The original PS2 version like never came fucking close
like
to that.
Like 8 frames, yeah.
Yeah. So that I think makes a big difference in how it plays too, and also supports the realism like concept.
For sure.
Like when he moves around like Nathan Drake. Like that's what it feels like when you're running and jumping. Like you feel like you're playing an Uncharted game. And that makes that reinforces the realism thing. But I would also say, like, yeah, the level of increased detail, not only on your character, but on the Colossi characters' faces and arm, like all that stuff. Really, I think I don't know if it better serves the thesis of the game, which I don't really want to talk about for people that haven't played it, like should experience it on their own. But it definitely, you're right, Plant. It's a sadder
game. Yeah, that's. I think we can talk about that in broad, non-specific terms, because a lot of the, and it's interesting really about how much this conversation's mirrored in Monster Hunter World stuff I've seen from folks who've never really played this game on Twitter is like, I don't, it's kind of sad to kill these monsters. And I think, I think it's because the animations are so much more expressive. And so there's a lot more personality in the things that you're fighting in both games, especially in like Monster Hunter World, when an enemy's weak, they start like limping. And in Shadow of the Colossus, like you don't want to kill the big dog. Like that's kind of sad. And while Monster Hunter World is in this regard, doesn't really consider that. It's like, yeah, kill him and turn him into a shirt. Shadow of the Colossus is like kind of completely about that. It is explicitly about the impact you're having on the environment. Yeah. And I think that's, I don't know. I think that's really interesting that like, this is not just, it looks better. There's a lot of stuff about the tone of the game that I feel like would improve because things feel more real. Like the things that you are doing, the like ethical questions that it raises about the things that you're doing have like a lot more weight because it really feels like you are ending a life, even if that life is gigantic and made out of, you know, stone and moss and stuff.
I think
it is funny. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say it is funny, you know, making that comparison because, yes, they're both about giant monsters. But structurally, like,
couldn't be more different.
It couldn't be more different to the point where it's like, it's weird when I hear Griffin talking about, like, you know, I want to grind to get more powerful to like see the next great monster. Like, Shadow of the Colossus throws crazy, awesome monsters at you back to back to back to back to back. To the point where, like, you know,
and there's nothing else.
There's nothing else. Yeah. Like, there's no cruft to it at all. Like, there's no, you don't need like potions. You don't need to hone your weapon. It's about like, how do I conquer this monster given this limited tool set? And obviously, a very different game. But it's interesting because, like, I don't know, time is short.
Yeah.
And I think for people that want to experience the idea of having like big monster fights, this is like a it feels like a much more honed
this comparison is very clumsy. No, because that suggests that like the hunt side of Monster Hunter, where you are going around and collecting stuff and like making better shit and like figuring out what kind of build you want to work towards and then working towards is work. And it's not like it's really fun because that is the game. I think any comparison between these two, aside from the fact that they are big monsters that you maybe feel a little ethically torn about slaying, is about as far as the comparison should go, because otherwise it is fucking apples and oranges.
I do see what Fresh means though, in the sense that I think the average person, if they're like, I want a video game where I hunt big monsters, ironically, what the art of Monster Hunter is, I would 100% recommend this to pretty much everybody who is a casual person. If that was the description they told me. I think if somebody said I was really into collecting things and the intricacies of RPG systems and like questing, I think Monster Hunter World would be the jam. I think the only thing, you're right, they're totally different, but because the name of the game is Monster Hunter, I can see how people might be a little confused.
Yeah, it's not Honey Seeker.
Yeah. But anyway, the one other thing that I did want to say that's kind of connected to this is what I also enjoy about playing this game now, after having played a long time ago, is I feel like these big, risky art project games of that period are getting, I feel like people are finally starting to borrow some of those ideas again. And by that, I'm talking about Shadow of the Colossus, but I'm also talking about No More Heroes. Do y'all remember that? The Suda 51 game?
Yeah, of course.
It's like a big open world and there's nothing to do in it. And it was this like weird period of time where everybody, to make an open world game didn't mean that you had to pursue like perfect, hyper-realistic graphics, which in turn, because it costs so much to make something hyper-realistic, you have to fill it with a trillion things to do to like net a certain amount of value out of your game. Like, you could make an open-world game and the design of the open world could be as purposeful and uncluttered as like a traditional linear game. And I feel like we're seeing a little bit more of that. I feel like we're seeing a little bit more of like open world game design, like not feeling like they have to have a mini map that is covered in things to do, or at least not have a screen that's covered in just junk.
Yeah.
And it's so refreshing going and playing something like this that doesn't have those expectations and does feel like it has this holistic sense of purpose in its design. And it's not afraid to have an empty world. And like the point is that it has an empty world.
You are making actively emptier. Like, yeah, and that's what the game's about.
I do feel weird, just to go back to the realism thing real quick. it's there's something about the main character, and I've only played like the first couple Colossi, but there's something about the main character's like face. I don't know. It makes me feel very uncomfortable. I think it's because of that fairy tale thing that you were talking about, Plant, which is like, when I think of him as a hero in the past, he was like an iconic, like, I don't know, a representation of like a man. And now this is just this kid.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Very disconcerting.
Seeing the faces across the board is upsetting.
Now, the big question on everybody's lips is, are they also going to do a remaster of the 2007 Adam Sandler drama Reign Over Me, which inexplicably featured a lot of the original Shadow of the Colossus?
Love that game and that movie.
Very sad.
It feels weird deciding what the best game of the month is, because Shadow of the Colossus is one of the best games of all time, but is the does the remaster get that also? I like...
I'm going to DQ it, to be honest. One, because it's
I think that's
a
fair...
But two, I in terms of like the conversation at the end of the year, we can bring it up there, but I'd rather it be something that we can talk about that's brand new.
But I would second Chris Plant's note, which is to say, like, if you own a PS4 and haven't played this game, holy shit,
play this game. Yeah.
It is really phenomenal. And if you, especially if you, like, bounced off of Cat Dog game. What was that game called?
Trico.
What is it?
Trico, the game.
Last Guardian, yeah.
Last Guardian, thank you. If you bounced off of that, I think this is by far my favorite of the trilogy. And I think it nails a lot more of what it was trying to do than Trico the game did, in my opinion.
My vote's for Monster Hunter. I think it's a masterpiece.
It's a slam dunk. I'm in love with it. Subnautica is very cool though, and well worth your time if you want to check it out.
I mean, all these games are. It was a killer month. I know what I said at the beginning, but it was. I do want to say one thing
about Subnautica that I meant to mention during it, because it was, and it's actually really. It's kind of a funny problem, but because it's been in early access so long, a lot of guides and videos for this game are completely useless. Like, they're completely I cannot tell you, like, three or four times I was like, where the fuck is this thing? And I would follow a video for several minutes until I realized, like, wait a minute, this UI looks pretty different from the one I'm used to. It's like, yeah, this is called a different thing. It's a completely different world. And also, all the water is jelly beans. It used to be jelly beans, and now it's water.
That sounds like a better game.
Sounds fun.
Yeah.
It does sound good. So Buenos Blob 2, the open world, Buenos Blob.
Well, it'll be Buenos Blob 3.
Thank you.
So are we doing Monster Hunter?
I would vote for Subnautica personally, because Monster Hunter still hasn't clicked for me yet, but I'm fine with that. I was going to say the same thing.
Okay, let's make a run then.
I like Subnautica a lot.
I think Subnautica is really cool.
I think Subnautica does... something in a survival game that, like, I haven't really experienced in a very long time, which is, A, you were talking about satisfaction. I think it's extremely satisfying to explore. And B, I did not feel like I played for 2 or 3 hours and did not need a guide. And for survival games, not requiring a guide for the intro is like a really fucking well-designed game.
My
only problem is I haven't played it, which it's the only game of these.
We do kind of do a thing where we say, like, hey, what games are we doing, so we can all kind of like play them and have something
to
add.
Well, here's the problem is I was playing Monster Hunter.
Also
the bigger thing that it's 3-1.
No, I'm fine to...
Something tells me Monster Hunter World will show up in a
It would have to be a fucking good year for me not to like try to get Monster Hunter World.
It also seems like it's not gonna be that year.
Yeah, hey, this is a fun thing we can do in our January episodes. 2018. What's going on here? I think maybe this is an expectations thing, because 2017 was. Fucking great, and it's gonna be. I mean, with the Switch launch and like pretty much most of the games we talked about in the year end thing had some Switch version of some kind or were Switch exclusives. I'm worried that we're gonna hit that sort of Nintendo year two slump a little bit.
You're not gonna have a Zelda, but like,
I'm gonna hit a quick list provided to me by partner site IGN. partner site in the sense that I'm reading this, and please don't sue me, but they've collected this data handling. Just some games that might... A Way Out is coming, 2018. Anthem.
That's the zombie one?
No, A Way Out is
Anthem,
the
Anthem was
player.
Delayed.
Anthem
got
Anthem
delayed.
Was delayed to spring 2019. But
okay, so thank you, IGN, for shitting the bed.
Red Dead Redemption 2, Sea of Thieves.
Red Dead.
Crackdown. Maybe.
Kingdom.
Darksiders 3, maybe?
Metroid Prime coming out this year?
Maybe. I would doubt that, but Detroit Become Human, I'm kidding. Please don't say anything. Far Cry 5, always
Kingdom
good
Hearts,
for...
Kingdom Hearts 3, I don't know about Far Cry 5. Shenmue 3, definitely coming out this year.
God of War?
I think it's too early. It is too early. I don't think in January of last year we knew. Well, we knew all about Mario the Switch Zelda, shit, yeah.
Game of the year, future game of the year, Marvel's Spider-Man that's coming out.
Oh, yeah, that looks good.
Great. It looks great.
Looks great, sure. I don't know. And all the Microsoft game. Exclusives.
Yeah, it'll be all right.
It could happen. Here's my prediction. Half of everything that you just listed will get bumped to 2019.
Thank you. Yes,
that
I agree.
Right.
I pretty much nothing I feel like we've seen at recent E3s feels like it's coming out this year. I'm hoping it will. Here's my other prediction, though. Are you ready for this? Four big games will be announced and come out within 3 months of the announcement.
They're doing that now.
I think that's what we'll see most of this year. I think
Cloverfield,
especially Bethesda. I think Bethesda
does
that.
Cloverfield the game.
Are they able to do that because we're getting worse at our job?
No, they're doing it because we're getting better.
Sure.
No, it's true. They don't want the hype. The hype now doesn't benefit them.
Yeah, it's also worth mentioning.
You know, not to dog on all old video game things, but you know, they could kind of count on a certain degree of like, yeah, this is going to be the best game ever. You should definitely reserve it. And not so much.
Yeah, that's. We can also like two of the last few years, like my games of the year were smaller games that I didn't know even existed in January. Like I'm thinking of like Stardew Valley and Undertale. And I'm sure there's going to be stuff. Wargroove comes out this year. That one looks good as hell. That's going to scratch that.
That's the like Fire Emblem.
Yeah,
Advance Wars one
that looks really, really sick.
Oh, shit. The actual Fire Emblem Switch game. I'm very excited about that.
Oh, I can't wait to tuck into that one.
Shut up, Justin.
I can't.
Shut
up. I love Fire Emblem. In.
Yeah, it'll be a good year.
It's called Fire Emblem World, and you're going to love it.
It'll be a good year. It's just like not at... In 2017, I feel like in January, we're like, new Zelda, new Mario, new everything. And it's a little bit less obvious, I think, with the
yeah,
jams.
And PUBG was like a total dark horse, too, last year. That no one saw coming. I think we'll have surprises.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be an interesting year.
Cool. Well, that will have to do us for right now until next month. But we hope you will join us for that. Meanwhile, you can visit polygon.com to read a lot more great stuff. But until then, be sure to join us again next time for the besties. Because shouldn't the world's best friends pick the world's best games?
Besties!